You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, March 13th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Stephen Cook from the Council on Foreign Relations. We're talking about the Netherlands and Turkey, diplomatic crisis that might be empowering a totalitarian president in Turkey and propelling the far-right xenophobes to victory in the Netherlands. Plus, Mike Flynn, the Russia connections are there, but they're sketchy. But he literally was a foreign agent of Turkey through pretty much all of the campaign. We'll be talking about that. And Mike Hanna, veteran reporter for CNN, Al Jazeera, now independent consultant and presenter on Al Jazeera, will talk about the UN's new campaign against sexual abuse and sex crimes by UN peacekeeping forces, the Trump age in the United Nations, and the state of South Africa's contest to be the next leader of the African National Congress as corruption deepens under the presidency of Jacob Zuma. Much more impressive person than Donald Trump, but maybe with some of the same tendencies in many senses. We'll get to that and more with Mike Hanna and Stephen Cook. Healthcare, the Republicans can't get their message straight, even the ones that are on the same side of their comically horrific bill. Tom Price, no one's going to lose insurance. Paul Ryan, it's up to people if they lose insurance. I guess in the sense that it's up to them if they don't quadruple their incomes overnight. They can't get on the same side of that. And Dean Heller and Tom Cotton are like, actually, we represent full states. We would prefer to not completely screw our own political careers over to support illogical and savage cuts. Obviously, in Tom Cotton's case, not out of any moral concern, but political calculation. The regulatory agency fight that Chuck Schumer must fight with Donald Trump as agencies get staffed up over the next couple of months. New video emerges that adds a wrinkle to the Mike Brown case. Shocking. And a Kurdish women's worker cooperative in Rojava gives another lens into Kurdish politics and the crisis there. Matt, will you grab those two things in the printer for me? Por favor. All that on more on today's Majority Report. Now, I just want to get to this up top because a number of people tweeted this at me. Thank you. And this was sort of the rage yesterday, at least. Steve Bannon apparently lived a sort of life of a kind of very, very wealthy neo-fascist couch surfer over the last couple of years. And there was a Washington Post report about how he sort of kept no fixed address and might have been registered to vote in different places and so on and so forth as he was building up Breitbart News and then, in fact, becoming a strategist for Donald Trump. But what really leapt out at people was that according to one property he kept in a 2015 email from, this was actually a property that he rented. This was from Bannon's former landlord that read, "The entire jacuzzi bathtub seems to have been covered in acid." And Bannon responded by saying, "I'm out of town. Is there any way you can talk with Diane," who I believe was his partner at the time, "and sort things out? Three question marks." Now, look, I just want to say here, and I know this is going to be very weird coming from me because I am certainly no Democrat when it comes to political warfare. And I think we need to actually really beat our opponents and not cede any ground. But I just want to say, I mean, I think the idea that Stephen Bannon, like, dissolved a body in his jacuzzi is ridiculous. I mean, I could never picture someone like Stephen K. Bannon doing anything like that. And by all appearances, even though we have really profound disagreements, I'm sure he super values human life. Another thing that I can never picture Stephen K. Bannon doing, and I'm not just talking about from his writing or his ideas or his many opinions he's shared, but even just from his basic physical appearance, one thing that I would never, ever think, it would just never even occur to me that he might do, would be, as an example, have a prostitute kill her and dissolve her in his jacuzzi. I just think that that's totally out of bounds. Something he would absolutely not do. And I think we need to be a little bit more civil moving forward. So Stephen K. Bannon, there's no explanation of why there was acid in his jacuzzi, but I just want to say definitively that I do not think, it's because he dissolved the body in there.
The basest motive for having a jacuzzi full of acid is not necessarily the main one.
I feel like using the bathtub is the more standard approach. And, you know, I watch a lot of murder shows.
Yeah, not in Florida. Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah, get the gators out there. We got Bungo.
I said it was like Eastbound and Down meets Man in the High Castle.
I'd also recommend that everybody look, if you don't, if you're just listening to this, watch the YouTube for the sort of my facial expressions and my words were not synchronized in that segment, to say the least. I want to talk to you about texture. With everything going on in the world, it can be hard to keep up with all the latest political moves and perspectives, as you know. And I know that many people who listen to this show every day are like news factories. These are an audience of people that read and listen to a lot of stuff.
Somebody messaged me over the weekend asking for the texture link.
It really is a great app. With over 200 magazines available, Texture puts an endless supply of in-depth interviews and articles into the palm of your hand. I use a Texture for everything from Rolling Stone, Wired, Sports Illustrated, but then also I like that I curate. So, you know, I always use the example, Matt Taibbi is someone I never want to miss. And you really start to be able to create your own magazine. So my magazine might run from war crimes in Yemen to yoga. I get to make it all happen on Texture. It's an awesome app. And thanks to Texture's daily recommendations and exclusive interactive features, you can easily pinpoint the articles that you want to read. And it's searchable, everything from National Geographic, which I've actually started to look at a little bit more because of Texture, to Fast Company and Rolling Stone, is available for way less on the Texture app, which was selected as one of Apple's top 2016 iPad apps. Texture is normally $9.99 a month, but if you sign up right now at texture.com/majority, you get 14 days free. That's 14 days free. That's 14 days to try Texture for free when you go to texture.com/majority, texture.com/majority. I'm always comfortable when I host, and it's not just because I'm relaxed behind the mic. It's because I have finally followed Matt Leck's lead, and I'm in the MeUndies world. If you've been settling for store-bought underwear 5-packs, I have something that will change your life for the better. That is, of course, MeUndies. And I'm telling you, quite literally, right now, my life is enhanced because of MeUndies. It's seriously soft, feel-good underwear that gets delivered right to your door. Designed in L.A. I met a guy when I was out in L.A. a couple weeks ago. I was doing the Young Turks. I shared a Lyft ride with a guy and, you know, it's L.A., so you're literally – it's not like a rideshare in New York where you're like, hey, what's up? And you're out in the car in 5 minutes. This is someone that you better get along with because you're in the car in traffic for like 2.5 hours. And he was a really nice guy, and turned out he was interested in Majority, liked TYT, and was a MeUndies designer. And I was able to tell him how awesome his product was. It is designed in L.A. I can personally attest. I met a designer. Designed in L.A., and made from sustainably sourced micromodal, a fabric that's three times softer than cotton. MeUndies, softer than soft. Luxe undies come in ever-changing selection of classic colors, bold shades, and adventurous patterns.
I go with the adventurous.
I have no doubt that you do. That you can go to tailor to your own personal style. And guess what? You can save up to 33% each month with a monthly subscription. Simply select your style, size, plan, and MeUndies will send you undies that you'll... that they think will make you swoon for each month. And if you're not ready for a subscription, that's okay. You can still save because MeUndies is offering $20 off your first pair. Just use our special URL, MeUndies.com/majority. Get 20 off of your first pair. So go ahead. Revamp your underwear drawer. You deserve it. Once again, that's MeUndies.com/majority. MeUndies.com/majority. Folks, we will keep you posted, obviously, on Facebook and Twitter, but there is a very high likelihood that we won't have a show tomorrow because of this storm. And usually, even with storms, Sam's like, I don't care if it's happening out there. We're going to go do it. Because even if people are dying on the streets, I want to talk about Medicare. But I don't think
it's true.
It's totally true. So it might not actually work tomorrow. So just a forewarning, not 100%, but we're probably at 80, 90% likelihood we won't have a show tomorrow. But we'll be back on Wednesday. We'll be right back with Steve Cook. And stay tuned to our social accounts for final word on that. We'll be right back with Steve Cook from the Council on Foreign Relations.
Kick out your front door. How you gonna come? With your hands on your head or on the trigger of your gun? When the law breaks in, how you gonna go? Shot down on the pavement or waiting on death row? You can crush us, you can bruise us, but you'll have to answer too. Oh, guns of Brixton. Money seems good and your life you like it well, but surely your time will come, as in heaven or as in hell. Oh, oh. Come. They come, you know it means no mercy. They caught him with a gun. Now he lives in a Black Maria. Goodbye to the Brixton sun. You can crush us, you can bruise us, but you'll have to answer to. Oh, guns of Brixton.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Stephen Cook from the Council on Foreign Relations. Steve, how you doing?
What's up, Michael?
It's great to be talking with you.
I'm happy to be back chatting with you.
Good day, sir.
Every time you do that, I can't stop. I'm in all seriousness,
yes,
and I've been working in Washington for a while and in this field for longer, and I had never heard of Sebastian Gorka until 3 weeks ago, and now every time you open your mouth, you personify the guy. It's just
excoriating.
Do you want to have an interview, or do you just want to have me laughing on the other end of the line?
Well, the Jew is very susceptible to humor. Okay. All right. I've indulged myself.
Oh, my God.
Okay. All right.
I'm going to try to compose myself now. Okay.
Me too.
All right.
Okay. So really quick, we're going to get to this diplomatic crisis that is heating with Turkey and the Netherlands and tease that out. But I want to just briefly touch on General Flynn, because
oh, okay.
What's astonishing to me is that you know, I always stipulate, I think that there's enough weird smoke patterns that there is some fire there with the Russia stuff. But it's not, you know, it's certainly what's on the public record is amorphous. It's all over the place. He ended up losing his gig because of the calls with Russia. But what we literally know is that up through the campaign and right before the inauguration, he was literally a paid agent of the Turkish government. And, I mean, you know, especially the way things are now, both domestically and the way Turkey's projecting internationally, I mean, they're not an adversary, obviously, but they're not exactly synchronized with us.
Oh, no, not at all. I think going back as far as 2011, you could really think of Turkey more as a frenemy than a friend or an enemy. I had actually used that Paris Hilton term in an article about the Turks going back that far, because the Turks have a very strong view of what their own interests are and a very strong nationalist narrative about not towing the American, Western, or NATO line, even as it has been a valuable ally of the United States during the Cold War. And that is, and there have been plenty of instances over the course of the last 5 or 6 years where the Turks have pursued their own interests at the expense of the United States, which I think if you think about those instances, whether they were in the Balkans or in the Middle East or with regard to the Russians, and then you put together the fact that Flynn's firm was working for this Dutch firm, which was really just a front company for the Turkish government, makes it all the more disturbing.
Yeah, and of course, you know, I mean, look, I think pointing out hypocrisy, and I'll just give a brief editorial, I think pointing out hypocrisy on the right is completely irrelevant and not, you know, it makes no difference. But it always is notable that particularly with Flynn, who, you know, built his whole campaign on, you know, ranting and raving in this sort of like vitriol around Hillary Clinton, you know, the irony abounds. But, you know, yeah, and I mean, but I just want to, the other thing, I mean, and you can respond to that too, obviously, but just, you know, the only other sort of points that I want to touch on about this are kind of funny in two different ways. I mean, one, and I think was the piece that he wrote in The Hill about Fethullah Gulen, and you can give a you know, brief intro to Fethullah Gulen, but whatever we think of Fethullah Gulen, comparing him to Osama bin Laden is crazy. And, you know, Mike Flynn did that. And then the second part, though, that's funny to me is that besides the Hill documentary, you know, Flynn's firm produced this, like, Monopoly board meme. You know, there's this other part of the story where it's like you got paid $500,000 to do all this work for Turkey, and all it amounted to was a Hill column that no one took seriously, a story that was underreported about his own conflicts of interest, and you know, maybe it would have paid off if he stayed in his job and he sold out the Kurds and he, you know, backed Turkey to the hilt in Syria, maybe. But as like a PR or a strategy guy, it's like, this is just another hustle. And he actually hustled the Turks.
Well, look, I don't know whether he hustled them or not, but there's a reason why Michael Flynn was fired from his last two jobs.
Right.
And that's because he's basically an incompetent. He certainly excelled at that tactical intelligence that was necessary in the fights in Iraq and Afghanistan. But when it came to management, when it came to strategic thinking, he clearly failed in both areas. And what's funny about the story in The Hill and the op-ed in The Hill is that, you know, on July 15th and July 16th, Flynn was one of those retired generals who was actually supportive of the failed coup in Turkey. And then suddenly, clearly his client got upset with this. And then he subsequently wrote that piece in The Hill, which, you know, looked at Fethullah Gulen and cast these, made these claims about Fethullah Gulen being similar to Osama bin Laden. I mean, my remark when I read that piece was, it was clearly written in Ankara. You know, and
give
it,
everybody
just,
like the 1 minute or 30 second primer on Fethullah Gulen.
Well, so this guy Fethullah Gulen is a Turkish cleric who went into self-exile in 1999 and lives in the Poconos.
Right.
which is pretty hilarious because I grew up on the East Coast, and I just remember the TV commercials for Mount Airy Lodge in the Poconos, you know, where you could have like a champagne bath and a heart-shaped bed. And meanwhile,
in the backyard of it, there's these like Gulen Al-Qaeda guys like doing those like obstacle course trainings that Al-Qaeda used to release. Like, while you're up enjoying your heart-shaped honeymoon, the underground, there's a war, an army being trained.
Well, that's the thing. Every time someone mentions Petula Gulen and his hideout in the Poconos, I think of the champagne tub at the Mount Airy Lodge. And, of course, Sebastian Gorka hiding under the couch watching these guys.
I was doing deep counterintelligence training by trying to abduct young women into the heart-shaped room at the Mount Airy Lodge. SJW, beta cock.
So, Gulen.
Sorry,
Gulen and his followers insist that he is this voice of liberal, tolerant Islamism, and his teachings incorporate science and Western thought, and so on and so forth.
Big charter school guy for people interested in the United States. There's a lot of Gulen charter schools,
right? Yeah. There are in Texas, in California, and Illinois. And then on the flip side, those who are quite critical of Gulen see him and his many followers as trying to infiltrate the Turkish state and overthrow the Turkish state from within. And that's why this coup narrative about Gulen, engineering this coup from Sailorsburg, Pennsylvania, has become such a powerful narrative in Turkey. If you meet Gulenists in the United States, there's this kind of ethereal air about them, but they have been involved in some sinister things in Turkey. No, there's really nobody who's neutral on Gulen in Turkey. And so now he's public enemy number one.
Right.
And the Turks have kind of spun this narrative about them being the Gulen is being the same as, you know, Al-Qaeda and Gulen being like Osama bin Laden, a narrative that Flynn embraced in this article in The Hill, which is, you know, look, whatever you think about Fethullah Gulen, he is not Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, I mean, that's like calling like Gordon Brown Stalin. I mean, you know, like, right. I mean, that's just insane. Like, yes, regardless of what you think, like, this is a moderate Sunni. Yeah, I mean, it's nuts. Anyway, you know.
It's a worldview. Yeah, right. I mean, they very well may have been a threat to the secular Turkish state.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that President Erdogan and his Justice and Development Party partnered with the Gulenists for 10 years before there was a falling out between the two of them. So talk about cynicism and hypocrisy. Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party are engaged in it as well and have, you know, gotten, and Flynn has gotten himself involved in it as well.
Well, maybe there's other parts of the region where they have, in fact, partnered with those types of groups in actuality, right? But at any, yeah, I mean... But let's then, I mean, this gets us into the mind frame, though, of Erdogan. And at this point, you know, I remember even a couple years ago when you and I first started collaborating, it was still, you still could have a little bit more of a conversation of, okay, Erdogan is obviously the guy in charge, but how many, like, are there other players inside the government? Are there other, you know, and now at this point, we can very confidently say, I mean, this guy is really, you know, he's an authoritarian, he's running the show. And he's pushing a referendum that will be voted on, is it in April or May, Steve?
April 16th.
April 16th, thank you. So to give himself more power as president, to basically shift that role and, you know, instead of going back to being prime minister, just make the presidency a much more powerful office. And, you know, he actually, the polls are mixed. Like if there's a clean vote, he might lose it. Now, he was going to dispatch his foreign minister to the Netherlands, to the city of Rotterdam, where there's a lot of Turkish immigrants, and including people who still have Turkish citizenship, voters for this election. The Dutch government basically said, we're, you know, thrilled to have the Turkish foreign minister, but he can't come here and do a political rally. Now, and there's domestic political reasons for that in the Netherlands as well, which we'll get to. But Erdogan's response was to call the Dutch government Nazi remnants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of people throwing this Nazi word around recently. Right. Not good.
Not sad.
We should limit that to certain instances. Yeah. Well, look, right. From Erdogan needs that expatriate vote, at least as far as what we see in the polls. Now, I'll caution that in the June 2015 national elections in Turkey, all the polls suggested that the Justice and Development Party would run away with it and get basically the same amount as they had gotten previously, which was 49.9% of the vote. They didn't. They got 40% of the vote. And Erdogan forced, instead of their establishing a coalition government for the first time in the AKP era, Erdogan basically forced a new election the following June,
right.
The following November. And all the polls said, no, they're going to get exactly what they got in June, and they got 49.9%. So clearly the polls have not done well globally. I mean, the polls here, right. The polls, the Brexit polls, wherever.
Right.
But clearly Erdogan is nervous, and this is a guy who is paranoid like a good politician should be paranoid. I mean, he is an extraordinary politician,
right.
And he's not taking anything for granted. And those expatriate Turks are an important voting bloc for him. And they have been sending Turkish officials around Europe to rally people to vote yes in this referendum. And as you pointed out, the Netherlands has its own politics and its own election coming up. And the right-wing party of, I can't pronounce it, I think it's Geert Wilders,
yeah.
Geert Wilders, which is a, you know, nationalist party, post-immigration.
Virulently part of anti-Muslim.
Virulently, I mean, this kind of neo-nationalist right, or right. Nazi right, if you want.
Right.
So the Dutch government, trying to kind of outmaneuver them, said, look, no political rallies with all these, you know, Muslims and so on and so forth. And Erdogan's response, and then you had the protest turned violent, and it benefits both Erdogan, who is playing that nationalist card by calling the Dutch Nazis, and it plays to the benefit of Geert Wilders. They're feeding off of each other, and this is clearly going to help both of those politicians get what they want. Erdogan, what the Turks call an executive presidency, which is will shift the locus of power in the Turkish system formally from the prime ministry to the presidency. Mm-hmm. And Wilders' party, again, I don't know that much about Dutch politics, but he could very well win. I mean, can you imagine in liberal Holland? So an extraordinary couple days, and this diplomatic row doesn't seem like it's going to end. And that's all to Erdogan's benefit.
Yeah, I mean, and isn't this like one of the sort of prime concerns of our time, right? Like, if we could just, you know, sort of put this into a larger perspective for a moment, you know, I think, like, to me, the most disturbing thing about the sort of Russia and Trump thing is actually more what's just overt, which is that here are two, you know, far-right petrochemical guys who basically want to kind of, you know, turn the world into a giant oil, you know, a giant gas station, even more so than it already is. And you're either in the map or you're not. And there's a synchronized political interest there, which is incredibly disturbing in and of itself. And then you have these other situations that pop up. I'm always tempted to draw the, you know, the Israeli right and the Hamas analogy. And now you have it here where, you know, this is going to, as you say, it's going to massively benefit Erdogan. Wilders might not get into power because so far all the other kind of main parties, including the rightist parties, say they won't form coalition with him. But he was actually going down in the polls. And now he's been able to use this to really rebound and really ignite a lot of xenophobia in the Netherlands. So, you know, is this just sort of like the template of our time? It's like even when the right is beefing with each other, they're helping each other.
Yeah, you know, I think the problem that Erdogan has is that he happens to be a Muslim.
Right.
Otherwise, all these guys would be right there in with each other. I mean, you know, one of the real disturbing things, you know, whether let's take the petrochemical stuff and the Tillerson angle out of the whole thing with the Russians and so on and so forth.
Right.
And let's just look at what the kind of ideological motivation is for the improved ties with the Russians. It is based on to put it mildly and diplomatically, a profound mistrust of Muslims and a desire to form a broad global coalition against extremism. They call it extremism, but it's really against Muslims. I mean, what is Geert Wilders worried about? He's worried about Muslims in Holland. So if you look at what's been happening, you have people like Representative Steve King, Geert Wilders, David Duke, and others all kind of coming together in social media, amplifying their message. And it's all about anti-Muslim bigotry. I think that Trump benefited extraordinarily, not just from the Mexicans are rapists and let's build a wall, but the anti-Muslim bigotry ramped up to a kind of anti-Muslim hysteria. And I think there's certainly the right has a lot to answer for this. But we also in general do, because we, for the past 15 years, have securitized our foreign policy based solely on this global war on terrorism that could be interpreted as a global war on Islam, which is what many Muslims saw it as.
And we sure have a high body count. Yeah.
Right. We sure do. And unless you have responsible leaders like the two immediate former presidents, President Obama and President Bush, you have to give President Bush credit for saying, look, we're not at war with Muslims. We're at war with Islam, with terrorists. Islam is a religion of peace. Those were responsible things to do, even as they were both securitizing our foreign policy. But then you get irresponsible people. You get people like Sebastian Gorka, people like Representative King, people like Donald Trump, who are going to use that to advance an agenda that is based on an ideological worldview that is just suspect of Muslims, generally speaking. And that's where you get the global template. That's where you get the connections, to my mind, with the Geert Wilders, with the Russians and others. They're all making common cause.
Right.
My Russian colleagues who work on the Middle East say they can't understand why the United States did not, this is their narrative, did not accept Russia's outstretched hand to collaborate in the fight against Islamic extremism. And we're like, do you guys realize what you did in Grozny?
Right.
Do you realize what you did in Chechnya? So I think this is a part that is, needs to be amplified a bit in understanding what all these connections are.
And as a final question, then because you made, and I agree with you that there is a cultural, so like George W. Bush's, and I'll editorialize, you know, obviously I have a problem with this rehabilitation of him. I mean, his foreign policy and treatment was grotesque. Sure. But I agree with you. The fact that he went out and sort of made that cultural point was very important. And, you know, President Obama also I had strong disagreements with, but much more responsible in action as well, certainly, as in word. But do you think that, you know, to me, and I'm kind of going to conflate two different things now. And of course, like these,
I won't hold it against you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. One of these, terrorism is a multifaceted thing, and there's variables that range from, you know, genuine ideological motivation that sort of could stand independent. Then there also, of course, is an environment where American misdeeds fuel an environment, or racism in Netherlands fuels an environment, right? And so it seemed to me that what was tricky from the more kind of pragmatic or liberal perspective, though, in certain policymaking circles, was that they, if you hesitate to kind of more robustly include in your critique and exclamation some of the reasons as to why people might be legitimately angry at U.S. power, then you're in a kind of awkward position, because you're simultaneously kind of like, hey, this isn't real Islam, but there are these just random Muslim people that are doing these horrible things. Again, it's not exculpatory, but it's part of the I think you need that in the exclamation.
Right.
And then just as a really quick addendum, what struck me, and these are probably people that I know you would never come across them as like a person who actually does policy, but, you know, there was that whole kind of like silly, like atheist crowd that would, you know, like the kind of, and I like him as sometimes, but, you know, the Bill Maher, Sam Harris thing where it was like, you know, just the snotty liberal arts version of anything that comes out of Sebastian Gorka's mouth. So that same Islamophobia got a lot of currency in our so-called liberal circles.
I think that's absolutely right. On the, you know, re-examination of American foreign policy, I think there's two things. I think there certainly are people who want to pick up the gun and fight against the United States because their family was blown up in a drone strike accidentally. I mean, I think they, and it's the fact that we haven't been able to have an honest conversation about that says that there's really something wrong in that foreign policy making community where we can't reexamine these things and understand it. But there's, at the same time, there's also this ideological worldview.
Right.
Abu Musab Zarqawi, who was the founder of what has become the Islamic State, was just interested in a cosmic war with the Shia and then a cosmic war with the West, regardless of whether the United States was supporting the Israelis to the hilt. Of course, that certainly helped. But so there are these two components that come together in this fight and that becomes this fight with terrorists. But we have not been, and I think you're absolutely right, we have not been as robust in explaining these things, and we haven't been as robust in that liberal world in taking on people like Bill Maher, who says things that are fairly close to the kinds of things that are being uttered within the White House right now. Absolutely.
Totally. Well, Steve Cook, as always, it's an immense pleasure. I know that I might be appearing on your podcast soon to read sections of Sebastian Gorka's thesis from Trump University in Counterterrorism Studies.
We're looking forward to that, Michael. I have to tell you. My non-work podcast. Thank you.
Yes, non-work. Crucial distinction. Yes. Non-work. Non-work.
Thank you.
Non-work. The Howard Stern of foreign policy, Stephen Cook, Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks so much, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Seth. Right. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye. Okay, everybody. We will be back in about 30 seconds or a minute or so with Mike Hanna. We're talking UN South Africa, giving you a global tour on today's Majority Report.
You gonna run out at the Gideon star. When all the money that they rob from ghetto youths ain't enough to fly you to Mars. When the system you defend start break down like a Lego. When the whole world becomes a ghetto, that's when you realize the whole of we are ghetto people. So tell me, suppose the slave don't forget the people. People, call them all. Remember, Haile Selassie never left the people. No time at all, not even an inch. Oh, no. Give me a phone, a demaka, a ital, no grabber. Make me call and start up on the rhythm proper. Every U-top shot apart the zigzagger. Make me show you what a clock a strike in a jam rocker. Politician, them a chatter tongue sharp like maca. Them not no vision, them a scammer, we a wave the banner. What kind of honor, uno no treat the youths with honor. Make me show no vibes. Not true, you're living uptown. When the banks fall down, then the whole of we are getting you.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Mike Hanna. He's a correspondent for Al Jazeera. Mike, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. You are a longtime UN reporter, UN watcher, new Secretary General, Secretary General Gutierrez, has sort of made his kind of prime goal of his new term in office to take on a very, very sort of long-standing and deeply disturbing crisis of UN peacekeeping forces engaging in sexual crime, sexual abuse. I'd like you to explain the problem and what the new Secretary General hopes to do about it.
Well, the first thing that he did when he came into office at the beginning of the year was to set up a task force to report back on him on why previous reforms introduced by the UN have not proved to be totally successful and what he should be doing now as an absolute priority. Now, that report has been produced, and Antonio Guterres has just released a proposal, series of proposals based on that report. Now, the issue of alleged crimes among UN peacekeepers has long been with the UN. One of the problems with it is that the UN itself cannot bring charges against peacekeepers who are accused of sexual abuse, for example, it is up to the member state who has provided the peacekeepers to take some kind of action against those who are accused of such acts. So the UN has been in a bit of a bind in the past because it suffers the consequences in terms of its reputation, in terms of the impact on its operations around the globe, and yet it has no direct control over those events in terms of dealing with them in a legal way. Now, what Guterres has now proposed, and it's still not very clear to what extent this will happen, but there does appear to be some kind of financial leverage now being involved. Now, if the member state does not conduct investigations, proper investigations within a proper time, then salaries to the peacekeepers, which would be paid to the state, are now going to be withheld until the issue is resolved. So there is a kind of punitive aspect to what he is suggesting now. How will it work? Well, let's see how it plays out in the weeks ahead. The other very important thing, though, is that he's established a victims advocate as a deputy to himself, which is a significant step forward because there will now be somebody in his office directly involved in policing all of these allegations and making sure that something is done about it.
Yeah, those are seem like very sensible steps. Are there countries that are disproportionately represented either in UN peacekeeping operations or with these specific sorts of charges?
Well, once again, here's another step that he's taken, and that is he's putting representatives into each of four countries where there has been a predominance of allegations of abuse, Somalia, South Sudan, Chad, and Haiti. Now, he will have representatives in each of these countries monitoring the activities of the peacekeepers they send. So there is a recognition that there are certain countries or certain areas in which there's a greater incidence of sexual abuse than in others.
So he notes that. And, this is sort of one of the kind of core challenges of the UN in general, is this sort of mandate to engage in these global operations, it sort of uphold some sense of international obligation, when at the same time there isn't the sort of really robust infrastructure of international law in certain ways. Just even as an example, as you were saying with the UN peacekeepers, they're not accountable to a process independent of their own, nation states, but at the same time, they're enforcing these international mandates. Now, I'm going to sort of open the lens of that much wider in the sense that now we have a U.S. administration that is probably uniquely hostile to the U.N., and that's quite a statement because, the George W. Bush administration was uniquely hostile to the U.N. We're sort of taking it to another level here. And I guess what I'm curious, as a longtime, UN reporter and someone engaged in the institution, in sort of two different aspects of it. One is, what sort of role do you think within the administration, and this will be the sort of first question, is Nikki Haley and the sort of representation of her at the UN, is that, in your sense, is this more of like a kind of, is she in a sort of John Bolton mold, which is there to sort of insult the institution and be sort of adversarial? Or is she there to sort of pay some sort of vague respect to it, but clearly she's not very much in the sort of center of U.S. policymaking, and neither is the U.N.?
Well, I think the question's still open on that. Yeah. And it's not really as kind of, you mentioned that it's an administration that is hostile to the UN. Certainly in terms of previous statements by President Trump, he's been pretty dismissive of the UN as organization. But one of the questions is whether he was dismissive of the UN as an organization that wasn't operating effectively enough, right, or whether he's against the very concept.
Right.
Now, the other question that needs to be answered is Nikki Haley answering to a State Department that is virtually non-existent at present? Mm-hmm. Or is she instead answering directly to the White House? Now, why this question is asked, she was one of the first representatives that the Trump administration put in place. Now, what has been said about the UN in the past, I think, can be kind of put on hold. I suspect that there may be moves within the Trump administration to use the UN as a form of international state playing. We know that President Trump is a man who thrives on exercising power, not necessarily constitutionally. And with the leverage that the U.S. has within the U.N., remembering that it accounts for some more than a fifth of the U.N. total budget, that's great leverage. Perhaps there's a possibility that President Trump sees the U.N. as a very effective way of engaging in international alliances, business alliances, as he would see it, while being able to be in a position of not committing himself to any of it. So, in effect, using the UN as some kind of front to be able to start exercising that power play that is likely to be the Trump foreign policy in the months ahead. Just very quickly, a very good example about this is what's happening with Syria at the moment. Now, this process had started before the Trump administration came in. Basically, John Kerry, the then U.S. Secretary of State, stepped back, or in a way was pushed back from the process, being taken over by the Russians, in effect, along with the Turkey, under the ambit of the UN made very clearly. Now, we know that Nikki Haley, coming into this scenario, which in a way she has inherited, is actually very supportive of it, publicly at least. This is a very good example of the U.S. in a way being able to take the back seat in a process. If it succeeds, perhaps it's going to put its hand up and say, yeah, we told you. If it fails, it's a, hey, we're not driving this car anymore. It's a very good example of a possible way in which President Trump can use the U.N. to establish alliances that otherwise may be very difficult to do. That's a very good way for him to be dealing with Russia behind the scenes, for example.
Well, and a great irony about that, Mike, is it's actually it's another way of leading from behind, which was a statement that, of course, was used endlessly against President Obama. But I guess in President Trump's case, if we're leading from behind fantastically or tremendously, it's a different thing. but where then, I mean, that makes a great deal of sense that he would feel comfortable using the UN as this sort of, you know, space for deal making, essentially. That sort of, you know, a place, a nice place with nice rooms in Manhattan to kind of, cut deals, exercise power. And again, I think that this is something that you can help an audience get more specific about, but I think that there are sort of two general images in the public mind of the UN that are sort of maybe, I don't know if they're value neutral or not, but there's one notion that there's these sort of the role in these kind of hard power things that you're talking about, everything from the UN Security Council authorizing or not authorizing an invasion to facilitating and conducting diplomatic work, unfortunately, oftentimes, you know, maybe to not to sort of much success. But then there's this whole other umbrella of issues that even when the UN comes up short on is still an incredibly important vehicle for human development goals, peacekeeping operations when they're effective, dealing with poverty, cultural preservation. These are things that are not sort of in the exercise of power in the same way and seem to be kind of really devalued, at least rhetorically again. So, and I know that different leaders inside the UN have kind of responded to this administration in different ways, some being much more kind of aggressive and calling out the rhetoric, others sort of, you know, being good UN diplomats. But do you think in the more sort of soft power aspects of the UN's mission and with that budget on the line, is that, you know, a real threat for some of the kind of vital operations that the UN does in fact conduct?
Well, let's just take a look. The UN Humanitarian-in-Chief Stephen O'Brien has just in the last couple of days described what is happening in some African countries as the worst famine, the greatest humanitarian disaster since the Second World War. Now, he has called for some $4.5 billion by July to be able to deal with this. Now, this is a kind of UN exercise, the calling on its member states to produce huge sums of money to deal with disasters around the world, this latest one being famine in Africa. Now, a man who prides himself on being a business person like Donald Trump is probably going to be asking, well, what's the money going to be used for? How's it going to be distributed? What is the connection between large sums of money and getting food to people on the ground? What we know is that people in certain parts of Africa are hungry. They don't know where the food is coming from on any given day. Is $4.5 billion going into the UN for disbursement going to address that? Or is this a repetition of the UN doing what it has done so often over in the past to try and change situations from the top down rather than from the bottom up? The UN spends huge amounts of money and energy putting what it calls governance in place in countries like Somalia and in South Sudan. It created South Sudan as the last of the UN states a few years ago. That is now a failed state. Somalia is a failed state. Is setting up governance in countries like that actually the way of properly dealing with the problem? Now, many critics would say no. Many people would say that the UN has got to look at the way it operates. It cannot continue operating like this because it is creating the very scenarios that leads to the disasters that it is now having to deal with. All of the problems that it's speaking about in Africa, they have one common linkage, and that is conflict. Conflict is a political issue. Is the UN doing enough to address the political aspects behind the humanitarian disasters that we see in Africa, that we've seen in Syria? Many critics would contend no, probably including the Trump administration.
Right. And then, but then I guess the question would be is does that just sort of get consigned to the not our problem bin? Or, you know, because I mean, I guess some of us would be wary of the notion that the Trump administration is full of people who are interested in sort of vigorously rethinking diplomatic processes to deal with the conflicts that underline humanitarian crisis. I think unless there's a hotel deal involved, I don't know about all of that. But at any rate, that is my editorial on that, Mike, which I understand you do not have to co-sign on as a very reputable reporter, but I do appreciate the slightly approving chuckle. If we can move to South Africa briefly, this is a country that you've covered as well for many years, including, I believe, you covered the first democratic elections in a post-apartheid South Africa. We are, you know, South Africa is in a situation where I guess we could just start with Jacob Zuma, who is someone who has been plagued by corruption allegations, was charged and acquitted of rape before he became president. Also a very charismatic figure, someone with incredible credentials as a leader in the liberation of South Africa, and clearly a sort of exceptional political survivor. But it seems like as we draw the end of his presidency that there's widespread disgust with him, but he still might have his way in terms of his preference for a successor.
Well, the issue to look at it is essentially, it is not so much a failure of Jacob Zuma or a personality type issue. Right. Jacob Zuma is an incredibly affable man, you know, some would call him a populist, but personally he's warm, he's engaging. Some would contend he's been an absolute failure as a leader, but I don't necessarily think it's a failure of Zuma as an individual. Mm-hmm. I think it's a failure of his constituent parts. I think there's been a major problem within the African National Congress that has been unraveling for a period of time now, and the peak at which it started falling apart completely was with the ouster of Thabo Mbeki at Polokwane back in 2007.
This is just for the audience, really briefly. Thabo Mbeki is Nelson Mandela's successor. He's the predecessor of Jacob Zuma and fired Jacob Zuma as his deputy president. Zuma sort of rallied and organized, took over the power, took over the party.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And the person who actually drove Zuma's succession is now in opposition, a man called Julius Malema. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue there is that, sorry, Julius Malema.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he put Jacob Zuma in power as a member of the ANC's youth group. The ANC, an old-style liberation organization that drove South Africa to the first democratic elections. Now, at that point, the ANC started to fall apart. The frictions within it started fraying. the anger at the way in which Thabo Mbeki, who had his critics but had the support of the ANC elderly leadership behind him, the anger started brewing then. It increased with what was seen as Jacob Zuma's really hard-headed, some would argue corrupt way of doing business and of affecting leadership. Mm-hmm. The very core of the ANC, older cadres, walked away, not from the organization, but from playing any role in leadership. Mm-hmm. The ANC lost a generation of very able leaders at that particular point. Meanwhile, the young guard who had been represented by Julius Malema moved away from the ANC, dissatisfied with the pace of reform and change in South Africa. That created this huge vacuum within which Jacob Zuma has thrived. Mm-hmm. The only way going forward for things to start to be pulled back together is for the ANC to go back to what its historic makeup was. It's always been an intensely democratic organization, rooted in grassroots support, going all the way through the cadres up to the very top. Mm-hmm. But it needs to bring back those people who've gone missing, that middle-level, morally sound, intellectually solid leadership who have walked away from what they see as a mess in the current ANC leadership. Now, that would all depend on this leadership battle that you mentioned. Somebody like Cyril Ramaphosa, who has his own critics. Cyril Ramaphosa, I know from many, many years ago, was going to be the person to take over from Thabo Mbeki. The ANC had it sorted out a long, long time ago. Mm-hmm. That got interrupted by the chaos around Jacob Zuma's ascension to the presidency. To get things back onto base, the ANC has to take a look at itself, take a look at what it has lost in terms of what made it in the first place. And that is the very essence, the soul of the ANC, which is a policy that is founded on non-racism, founded on a sense of truly democratic value that has as its core the desires of its grassroots support. And that is something that the ANC has lost, and that is something that it is yet to replace before South Africa can start moving forward in terms of its ongoing movement away from decades of apartheid to a truly functioning, proper democracy that actually does look after the interests of all its people, not just interest groups.
Then one final, really quick two-part question on that. The critique of Thabo Mbeki, as far as I understood it, was that he had moved away from that grassroots base through being a sort of intellectual technocrat kind of control freak, for lack of a better term. Zuma, the critique of Zuma is that he's moved away through kind of deal making or a certain type of crass populism, but also disconnect. Are those accurate representations of the disconnect? And is there any of these candidates, is it Ramaphosa, who can hope to get back to this sort of real, I mean, Frank, you know, nobility of the ANC tradition you're talking about?
Very quickly, you left out one name there, and that is Nelson Mandela, who was the first post-apartheid president.
And I've never heard of him,
Mandela,
Mike.
majestic yeah. man that right. he was, may not have been that good a president of a democracy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of, we are all feeling really good. There was a lot of Rainbow Nation stuff. But Nelson Mandela was not that good at actually getting nuts and bolts working.
Right.
It needed a Thabo Mbeki. Nelson Mandela was the first to recognize that, which is why he stood down after one term. It needed a Thabo Mbeki. It needed a technocrat to start getting the nuts and bolts together, to move South Africa on from a patting its back, we all love everybody scenario, to a functioning country in a modern world. Mbeki was the right person to do that. He had failures in certain social aspects, such as the treatment of HIV/AIDS, right. which has a long story attached to it as well. His basic function was actually to ensure that people had clean water, that everybody under the age of 12 was in school. These are fundamental things that were not done in the first few years of South African democracy that Mbeki put in place. Yes, he was an intellectual. Yes, he was reserved. Yes, he did not have Jacob Zuma's warmth and populist ability to be able to dance wonderfully at mass rallies. There is an essence of truth to the characterization of both of them, but to get the full picture, you've got to look at the process coming from post-democracy under Nelson Mandela, the developments that had happened under Thabo Mbeki, and the regression that we have seen in the years of Jacob Zuma.
Mike Hanna, I appreciate your time and your work immensely, and I hope we can do it again sometime soon.
Thank you very much, Michael. I've enjoyed it thoroughly.
Okay, thank you so much. Mike Hanna on the Majority Report, and we are going to move to the fun half. Again, almost certainly no show tomorrow. Stay tuned for our social feeds for final word on that. But it looks like Sam's going to have to talk about Social Security with his kids on a snow day.
I saw 3 to 5 inches per hour at the height of it tomorrow. I'm excited.
That's insane.
No,
why? Yeah, become a member of the Majority Report. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys and a podcast. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. The IMs are on. I'm calling into the phone system now. We'll see you on the fun half.